Welcome to the latest KleptoCast, the podcast series hosted by Hudson Institute's Kleptocracy Initiative. Every few weeks, we delve into issues of kleptocracy around the world, how they affect us, and what Western policymakers can do about it. I'm Belinda Lee, and our guest today is Kenneth Rijok, former banking lawyer turned career money launderer and now a financial crime consultant. He has written an autobiography titled The Laundry Man, based upon his own experiences laundering money for Colombian drug cartels and the mafia, and now runs his own blog that offers analysis and commentary on money laundering and financial crime. So, Mr. Rijok, can you describe what services you provided to your clients and how you were able to evade law enforcement?
Well, I was what you might call full-service enterprise, because it was my job to take the proceeds of criminal activity and run it through the three-step phase of money laundering, which I'll detail and give you an illustration. Money laundering is so difficult for law enforcement to identify on a real-time basis because it's composed of three separate and distinct phases. And if you don't catch me in the first phase, you'll probably never be able to locate the funds and interdict it while it's in action. The first phase is called placement. What is placement? Placement is where you take criminal proceeds, which would be cash or cash equivalent, and get it somehow, some way into the global banking system. That's taking cocaine profits earned on the streets of the United States and getting them into a Caribbean tax haven jurisdiction where they ask no questions about the origin of the money, that is the source of funds, and who actually possesses it, who controls it, who is the beneficial owner. The second phase of money laundering, of course, which is called layering, is that once you have got the money into the global banking structure, you must move it around so as to disguise its original criminal origins. This means taking money that you've already put into a corporate bank account that you control in a tax haven jurisdiction, moving it to one or more additional jurisdictions, hopefully in other parts of the world, so as to be able to foil any possible investigation, which means money going from a Caribbean tax haven may then go to a European tax haven, and then to a jurisdiction, say, in Asia or even Africa, where the anti-money laundering compliance is very poor or the situation is that the country is very corrupt. The last phase, of course, what we call integration, is where we are now moving our clean money back into a legitimate peacetime investment, and that is, for example, the money is now leaving its African area of deposit and going into a Western European financial center, later to be used as a disguised loan for a piece of property in North America. Integration is where you actually have got your money totally indistinguishable from legitimate capital into the peacetime and legitimate system. Now, my job, of course, was to execute placement, getting the money by bulk cash smuggling or other means into the banking system, and then moving it around. The clients generally took care of the investments. Some of them bought shopping centers in Canada. Some of them used the money and dumped it into cash-intensive businesses. And basically what they did was they took, which was very hard to secrete criminal proceeds, and at the end of the wash, dry, and fold process, it came out as legitimate income, for which they gladly paid taxes on, and became powerful citizens in wherever they chose to live.
So what role does anonymous companies in the U.S. and U.S. real estate play in this scheme?
Well, you know, while American bankers are always crying about bearer share corporations located in the tax havens of the Caribbean or countries in Latin America or even in Europe, anonymous companies is not just a tax haven item. forming a corporation in the state of Delaware and or out west in Wyoming or Nevada has pretty much the same effect, because using a corporate service firm, you end up with a company that is not traceable back to you as a beneficial owner, and that company can be used not just to launder money, but to make legitimate investments, particularly in conservative types of properties, for example, real estate, which rarely goes down in the United States. And as such, there's a bit of a furor up now in the United States about the use of these anonymous companies for the purposes of hiding the beneficial owner in the purchase of multimillion-dollar real estate. In Manhattan, for example, a large portion of the multimillion-dollar purchases, that means over $3 million, are all, I'd say 80 to 90%, owned by anonymous corporations. So the use of the anonymous corporation is the rule rather than the exception when you come to high-end real estate in the United States. And it is a problem.
And do you see politically exposed persons using the same money laundering methods as organized crime? And do you see this strengthening kleptocracies?
Absolutely, because the politically exposed persons who may be government officials, senior officials in non-governmental organizations, senior military or charitable organization heads, people who have access to other people's money and also people who can get bribes and kickbacks, will use pretty much the same methods to launder their criminal proceeds, that is their corruption proceeds, and secrete them in other parts of the world. And that's probably why the Panama Papers drew such a large following in readership, because people wanted to know, why was it that wealthy government officials in their countries who didn't really earn that much money had a lot of money to be putting into a Panamanian bank?
So, speaking from your personal experience, how does money laundering empower a criminal?
Well, you know, 30 years ago when I was sentenced in federal court in Florida for money laundering, the judge just flat out told me, listen, without you, your clients would be out of business. The reason that money laundering empowers the criminal elite is because it takes their criminal proceeds, which are, of course, very at risk for being seized by government or for being identified with them. It takes their money and it turns it into something that is a powerful agent for their own influence. If I am a drug trafficker and I have now been able to launder my money and buy a chain of automobile dealerships all across the state, I become not only wealthy and prestigious, I may be even making charitable contributions, I may be making political contributions, I may be becoming a powerful figure on my own in the legitimate political landscape. Not that I'm going to be running for Senate next year, because I probably wouldn't want that high profile, but what I do want to do is I want to retain the power that I have and expand on it. So the short answer to the question is, without the money launderers, the criminal elite would never be sufficiently empowered to, having cleaned their money, put it to use and use it to buy influence and win friends in the world.
A common theme that we see is that law enforcement is always trying to play catch up with the criminals. And there seems to be progress made in strengthening the U.S.'s anti-money laundering framework in terms of the Bank Secrecy Act, Patriot Act, and more recently, FinCEN's new geographic targeting orders. So in your opinion, what has worked and what still needs to be done?
Well, since the Money Laundering Control Act of 1986, the United States continues to increase its regulatory power and its ability to charge people with financial crime, and its regulations of the banks has frankly driven a lot of money launderers out of the United States or driven them underground. But after the regulations upgrade the bank status, then the money launderers go to the non-banks, the money service businesses, and from there they go to the Fortune 500 companies, to the privately owned companies, ma and pa companies, so to speak, which are closely held. They just keep three or four steps ahead of law enforcement because they're very inventive and innovative, and they know that it's a chess game. And so long as they are thinking three steps ahead, law enforcement has a real difficult time catching them, which is why so much money laundering has now moved outside the continental United States and is done around the globe.
What can the U.S. do then in terms of policies that we can enact that will create maybe even a small dent in this global phenomenon of money laundering?
Well, there are a couple of things, and some people might judge that to be radical. But first of all, when compliance officers at international banks don't do their job, they need to be charged with money laundering, and they need to go to jail. You can count the number of compliance officers who've gone to jail in the last 30 years in the U.S. on the fingers of one hand. I mean, it's only recently that compliance officers have been suspended and fined for what their negligence. They need to know that if they create an intentional tort, if they actively drop the ball, that they need to go to prison just like the person whose money they may be laundering negligently or intentionally. Additionally, the laws about identification of beneficial owners need to drop down to the state level so that nobody can own a corporation in the United States or bring a foreign corporation in without being required to absolutely identify the beneficial owners now and in the future. When we see that happening, then you're going to see the opportunities for money launderers dry up and see them flee the country.
Thank you. That's all the questions that I had today. And it was a pleasure talking with someone who's been both behind the scenes and also right now in the front lines of combating money laundering. So thank you so much for your time.
Thank you.